Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, this is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss the issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you have any comments you would like to make during this broadcast, you can either call them in at area code 646-716-4893, or if you're feeling a little radio shy, you can certainly write to me at bonkay@aol.com. That's bonkaye@aol.com, and we'll do our best to answer them. Before I introduce my special guest for tonight, I just want to remind our ladies who are listening that the healing weekend is only weeks away. It's the first weekend in October, and we're already in mid-August. So we will be having the healing weekend here in Philadelphia, October 3rd and October 4th. And it's going to be a really dynamite weekend with women from all over attending. And this is a time for us to share, to heal, to laugh, to cry, and to walk away with friendships that will never be matched again. Some long-term wonderful friendships will be made, and a whole new support system will be there for you. There is no cost for the weekend except your travel expenses and eating expenses. And this is my gift to our women once a year to make sure that you're on the right road to healing. So if you would like to attend, please get in touch with me at bonkay@aol.com and put in the subject box healing weekend, and I'll get right back to you. So if you'd like to join us, that's the place to be in Philadelphia for the healing weekend. Now, I would like to introduce my special guest tonight, who is a woman who I am in awe of for her many, many talents you know, she's a wonderful therapist, a wonderful kind-hearted person, a wonderful actress. In fact, she does it all. She has her own radio show, her television show that's online. It's amazing how much this one woman can do. So, Alexa, thank you for joining our show. Alexa Servidio is out of New York. Upstate New York, I'm sorry. Right, Alexa?
Yes, Westchester County.
I should know that because you're friends with my dear friend Carol, who's in Westchester. And thank you so much for joining us again, because whenever you're with us, you have such wonderful insight into healing, because you do a lot of this in your therapy. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for having me back again. It's always such a pleasure to be on your show. It's so powerful and enlightening, and I think what you're doing is so helpful, positive, encouraging to so many women that have gone through such trauma and betrayal.
Exactly. And people don't really understand this unless they are really experiencing it or if they've worked with it. And I know you've worked with lots of trauma. And you have a background, you know, with working with divorce, PTSD, interpersonal relationships, domestic violence, the worst of all, sexual abuse and trauma. So what is your feeling? Do people recover from this totally?
I find people recover, but I think like any type of loss, any type of tragedy, like a death, there's a part of you that still, yes, is suffering, but I think you learn to move forward. You learn to heal. You learn to kind of close the wounds a little bit in order to move forward. But I think it also takes, you know, a lot of encouragement, a lot of professional help, and also a lot of awareness to really look inside yourself and allow yourself to be that vulnerable to see what you're going to find and sit with it in order to start to heal.
I know for some people it's a lifetime process. There's always what I call a lot of residual scarring, so that, you know, it's not just a matter that the trauma's over and you'll wait a year or so and you're going to be as good as new. For some people who go through tremendous trauma, it really does take much longer. And I always say that there shouldn't be a timeline on healing. Because you can't say that one person's tragedy is as bad as another one, that we all go at our own rate and our own time with healing. Would you say that's pretty much true?
Yes, exactly. I think each person is so different. Each person's experience is so different that there's no set way of healing. There's no set time period, scheduling. I think that's really, you know, respecting each person, acknowledging their pain, and then allowing that person in their own time to peel back the layers. Because I think in time, it takes a while for your mind, your brain, to allow you to start handling some thoughts that maybe earlier on you weren't strong enough to handle. Maybe there's flashbacks that you need to, that in the beginning they were too stressful, too upsetting, that when you start to heal and you start to have a team and some coping skills, you're able to start remembering things. You're able to start really exploring things in the different layers and have the tools, because you can't explore all these and deal with such trauma unless you have some coping skills to help you get through that. It's almost, you know, ripping a Band-Aid off and hoping that this open wound will just heal on its own. You really need to have the right attention to it and the right support group.
I know that many times people don't understand trauma and post-traumatic stress. In fact, I was discussing it with one of my friends the other day, and she said, that's when you come out of the service and you're wounded. I said, no, that's not what post-traumatic stress means anymore. I mean, that's a part of it, but now there's a whole new world of post-traumatic stress. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, I think, you know, a lot of people associate it with veterans, with people who are in the military, with being in such, you know, in combat where you're so, in those life and death situations. That's one type of post-traumatic stress. But there's also post-traumatic stress if you're in an emotional abusive relationship, verbally abusive, mentally abusive, physically abusive, where you still have, you're living in that life and death type of heightened state all the time. That becomes your normal way of functioning, either if you realize it or if you don't. And it takes time and it takes a professional team to be able to start being aware that you're living in such a heightened state, because when you are in a physically or emotionally abusive, verbally abusive relationship, you're always waiting for the other shoe to drop. You never, you know, one day it'll be perfectly fine, and 10 minutes later, it's a big catastrophe. So I think living, you know, walking on those eggshells and living like that becomes your way of being. And it's, you don't know, after a while, you don't know how to turn it off. That's the way you survive. That's how you make it through whatever trauma. So I think that's what's really important, is be able to allow that person to start lowering their guard down so they can start learning what it's like to live and not have to be on that roller coaster 24 hours a day.
Alexa, when somebody comes into a marriage that's dysfunctional and they're coming out of a relationship at home that's dysfunctional, and I find that to be happening quite often, that many of the women who go into these relationships come from dysfunctional families growing up. So they're looking for something that's better than what they had, and even though it may not be perfect or great, it's a step up from where they were. So they really don't know any kind of real norm because they've never lived in a norm. And so I think that they just adjust to it because they grew up with abusive situations and they think that is the way people live. I mean, how do you get out of that syndrome of, you know, just feeling you have to be, you know, victimized your whole life?
Yes. What I've found with a lot of people that have come into my office is when there has been childhood trauma or conflict with your parents, consciously, subconsciously, as adults, we act that out and we seek people. Not most of the time, sometimes we don't even realize we're doing this. We seek people or around people who allow us to kind of interact that type of scenario, the distancer, the pursuer. And we keep people, I found a lot of times clients are reenacting, hoping to get a better ending, when really, even if they did for some reason get that better ending, that's not the answer. That's not what fills the void. And I think it's being really aware of what are you reenacting and being very conscious of it. And I've seen so many times in couples that have come into couples therapy, when I do a genogram about, you know, their side of the family, each person's side of the family, what are some important traits, what are some important themes, going back to like great grandparents, you will see, which is just amazing to really see how this all pans out, where there's both sides might have had alcoholism, both sides of them might have had a miscarriage or had a family that had mental illness or had deep loss. And just how it kind of plays out through the years of people trying to reenact and trying to make get a better outcome.
When there is, you know, severe mental illness in a relationship, when I'm diagnosed illness, and what do you advise women? How do you cope with this? If they have a husband who's bipolar or someone who's a sociopath, is there any way to fix this situation?
Well, I think it's that person who has the mental health issue, the illness, are they willing, one, to acknowledge it, and two, treat it and get support? If they're going untreated, they're in denial, there really is, it's almost being with someone who has an alcohol problem or a drug addiction. It's acting out. It's just they're not getting help. They're not willing to acknowledge it. So, I mean, I've had plenty of clients who've had relationships where someone was bipolar, someone was borderline, depression. But as long as they, you know, if medication was necessary, took their medication, had support groups, had, you know, very strong coping skills, was or is still in therapy, they're able to function with the highs and lows and live a very productive, normal life. But I think when someone is in denial and you become more of their caretaker, you become more of, you know, doing your life and your marriage or your relationship becomes more of damage control, that's where you start saying, okay, what's really going on? What am I doing? You know, is any of this enabling? Is this, you know, when do I take a step back? We can't go into relationships to fix people. The person has to want to work on themselves. If they don't, there's really nothing else you can do.
Alexa, I feel very strongly about this next statement, and I know people don't like to hear it, but you're a therapist, so I'd like to get your opinion. I know that a number of our women turn to antidepressants to cope in their situations, and I always say that that's red flag number one. If you have to take medication to stay in a situation, then I feel that's really a problem. If you need a medication to numb you or to make you not feel feelings because they're not going to be good feelings, then that really is a statement to me that there's something really wrong with the relationship. Do you feel that way also?
Yes, I think to some degree if the person actually thinks by taking the antidepressants it's going to change their tolerance level or make them kind of agree or deny what's going on in the relationship, that's not what medication does. And I think, you know, so many times people will say, okay, I'm borderline personality, I'll take the medication. They don't go to therapy, they don't go to DBT groups, they don't do anything else, they just take the medication and nothing seems to get better. Just like you can't lose weight without doing a diet and also exercising. They go hand in hand. You have to have both. And I think if you're just going for medication when it's really the other person's behavior that's causing you to be upset, I think it's really looking at that and saying, you know, this is also circumstantial. This is the environment. It's not going to get better unless the other person is willing to work on it too.
What are some of the steps that women who come out of relationships can take to start healing?
I think it's really not being so judgmental on themselves, to kind of allow themselves the first couple of months to have an awareness, to kind of look with new eyes what was going on, to start building their sense of self. So many times people define themselves by a person, by their marriage, their relationship. I think it's really finding about who you are, building that sense of self, what you bring to the table. So then when you are in a relationship in the future, you don't become absorbed into who the other person is, who the other person's problems are, and get caught on that roller coaster. When you have a strong sense of self, yes, you're there supportive of your significant other, but you're also supportive of yourself, and you know when to back out and say, hey, you know, this is becoming... you know, dangerous for me, this is becoming toxic for me. And I think listening to your gut and really working on that and saying, okay, what can I do? What am I looking for? What do I bring to the table? What do they bring to the table? And really making sure you're not there just to save or fix somebody.
I have a note that just came in from Anita, who's in Colorado. And she said, "Dear Bonnie, can you ask Alexa what women can do to gain confidence in a marriage where there is constant verbal abuse? How do I start to get strong enough so that I can leave?"
Yes. One, I know sometimes if you're able to go to a support group, if you're able to get a therapist, sometimes when you're in abusive relationships, physical or verbal abuse, you know, getting outside help you're not capable of doing that. I think it's also, you know, getting some positive affirmation, something that you can read, something you can say over and over again, listening to your show, getting the support, knowing that you're not alone, knowing that there's others who have gone through this and who have come out on the other side. Also, taking care of yourself emotionally, physically, mentally, spiritually. Is it going for a walk? Is it reading a book? Something that you make sure you treat yourself well. And I think it's very hard when the abuse is active. This is really, you know, this is tough. This is like combat when you're in that active abuse, when it's really being acted out. And it's being able to really start to realize that this is that person's problem. It's hard, you know, when they're saying such horrible things, not to listen to it, but to start almost maybe trying to numb yourself a little bit, to take a step back so you do start building that strength to be able to leave and to know that you do deserve better and you deserve to be happy, and no one deserves to be spoken to like that or treated like that.
Right. And no matter how many times they apologize, if they keep doing it, then it's just repeating it.
Yes.
I just had another letter come in from Janet. Janet is in South Carolina. I'm sorry, I couldn't read it. And she said, "Alexa, how do I set boundaries with my ex-husband? He is always manipulating me with my children, playing them against me." And that seems to be a complaint with a lot of our women. You know, when they split up, then the ex-husbands are always trying to manipulate the children, play you against them, you know, try to badmouth you in front of the children and make them, you know, team up with them.
Yes, yes. There's a lot. I've been seeing a lot
with
my clients.
Do you find that with the women you work with?
Oh, yes. And it's a lot now. Now it's really being known and recognized in the courts as parent alienation syndrome. So one, I would look into that when one parent turns the children against another parent. And I think by setting those clear boundaries with your ex is very important. I think that's your first step, and I really commend you for really coming to that point to say, I need to set those boundaries. And if he's not listening, and I know people don't like to go back to court and they don't like to get the court involved, but it's sometimes you have to. There might have to be supervised visits. There might have to be, you know, a therapist being involved, because this is also impacting your children. You know, having them, you know, this is very hard for them to going back and forth and this, the talking back and forth. But I think it's really sitting down with your ex, if that's possible, if not through an email, through a letter, kind of having some bullet points of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. See how far willing he is to work on things or is willing to accept things. I think then it's taking a step back and saying, are there any safety concerns? And then, you know, is this really going to be, is this an emotionally abusive setting? And do I have to go to court or get a mediator in? Because this should not be the way the rest of your life should be for you or your children. It's not how it's supposed to be.
How about in New York? Are the laws different there, you think, than in other states?
I think they're starting
to
be.
The
alienation, they're starting to be more acknowledged. About the parent alienation syndrome. People are starting to listen. Now, if you look a lot on YouTube and Google parent and alienation syndrome, there's a lot of therapists, there's a lot of experts that specialize in this. So this is a really great tool to Google it, look up the different therapists, the different psychiatrists, psychologists, and get their newsletters. See if there's a conference. Really educate yourself, because I find that's the biggest strength. That's how you really, you know, get that step ahead. Also build your self-confidence and realize this is not your fault. This is not about you. You didn't do anything wrong. This is the other person. And once you are able to release that feeling and that guilt that it has anything to do with you, you're able to see things clearly and start to move forward. That's part of the abuse. To keep you down and think that it's your fault, you did it wrong, there's never a way out. That's a form of manipulation and control. So the more you educate yourself, the more you build a network, you're able to break free and realize it's not, this isn't my fault, and able to start building your strength up again.
Do you find that women are, you know, who come out of bad marriages, I won't just speak for our marriages, I'm talking about in general any bad marriages, that they feel so void of emotion and so void of physical affection that they're just looking to jump into another relationship? Because I find that with some of our women, and I understand that, believe me, I do, and in fact I'm writing about it for our newsletter, that when you've been without someone to give you a kind touch, a kind word, and you've been living in that state of cold for so long, and may peel down your whole sense of sexual esteem and self-esteem, that as soon as some guy comes to you and starts building you up, you feel, you know, I'm falling in love again, long before you're ready to. Do you find that's a common denominator with women?
Yes, and also with men, too. I think sometimes when someone can come in and they say the right thing, they fill that void, they push that button that kind of gets you excited again and happy again, you can kind of fall back into that. And that's great to be that excited and to get those little butterflies again and be hopeful again. But I think it's also taking a step back and say, okay, it's not good to jump, you know, right in the first couple of months. Let me sit back and say, wow, this is great. I'm attracted to someone. This is wonderful. I'm feeling happy again. But time, they have to prove themselves. They have to, in time, actions, behaviors, and words have to line up. Everything is better when you wait and that there's time, and then you're able to see it. So then there's no questions. Usually within like 3 to 6 months, you'll start seeing if their words and their actions line up. I mean, I think it's, you know, filing it away, as I say it, in your mental memo book in your head. Say, okay, was this a little bit of a red flag, or maybe this didn't feel comfortable? Keep it in mind and just see if it keeps coming up. Is there a pattern?
Do you feel it's important for women to really go through some kind of help or therapy following a relationship? Because I know support is so important, but I still feel that when you come out of something so negative and abusive, and to many of our women it is abusive, not all, but many, that they really need to learn who they are again so that they can react in the proper way in future relationships and see what kept them lingering for so long in their, you know, current relationship. And if they don't get that help to see what it was that didn't allow them to leave there, then I think that they're going to repeat this behavior in future relationships. I always say there's so many predators out there, and they don't have to be gay. There's plenty of straight predators out there who are looking for vulnerable women to go and pounce on top of them because they know that you're in a vulnerable position. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, and I think when we have our friends or we have family members, they have most of the time, hopefully, best intentions, and you speak to them about your problems. But I think the difference is by going to a professional is that there's an objective person. This is all about you and what's going on. Sometimes people have different ways of thinking. They have, I say, their own stories from their childhood, their own monologues that play in their minds, in their own perspective. So I think when you go to a professional, it's fresh, it's new. You're able to say, okay, that you tell your story, and this person has no other agenda, does not know you, does not know your history, and is able to kind of put options out there. So it's really about you figuring it out and exploring it, about sometimes, you know, friends or family, they try to help and tell you what to do and what not to do, when it's really about you making that decision. It's you giving yourself the power. And taking that power out back and saying, okay, this is my decision, not someone telling me what to do. Because I think that's kind of how you got into this position in the first place, by having this abusive person controlling you, manipulating you. So we want to make sure it's you. You know, a lot of times people say, what should I do? Tell me honestly. Should I go back? Should I do this? And I said, either way, I will still be here. This is about what makes you feel comfortable. What is good for you? What do you want to do? This is your choice. And taking responsibility for your decisions. This is your own. You get to make this decision. It's very powerful.
Alexa, I know you come from a strong religious background and you're a true believer when it comes to God. Do you find any conflict in telling women to leave abusive marriages and religion? Because a lot of my women have hang-ups with this. Married for better or for worse, and, you know, God would not like you breaking up a marriage. How do you deal with that?
Well, within any religion, as I would say, especially, you know, with the Catholic religion, the Christian religion, if there is abuse, physical, mental, verbal abuse, it is not meant to stay. You know, I don't know if some people interpret the Bible that they're supposed to stay and put up with that. There's not. My uncle was a Monsignor, come from, you know, religious family, religious background, and not at all would I ever tell someone to stay because, you know, God will think bad because you left. People have to have their own decisions. People have to be able to take responsibility for what they do. And as it says a lot in the Bible, if you're living a good life, you're doing things out of your heart and being a good person, that's fine. But it doesn't mean that you have to stay with someone who is abusive, who is taking you down. And that's also, you know, allowing someone to mistreat you or being cruel to you, which is definitely not something that God or I would think priests or in any religion would say, okay, stay, because, you know, if this person is not willing to get help and to work on themselves, it's not, you don't have to suffer for them.
Are women deluding themselves when they say that I have to stay here for the sake of the children, when it's an abusive marriage or what I call a mismarriage, a mistake in getting married? I really do believe that children model themselves after their parents. And if they see a marriage that's void in love and affection, and a mother who's getting, you know, beat down, you know, either verbally or physically, and it just stays like that, then they feel that, well, that's the way life is, and they themselves will recreate that situation in their own future relationships. And I really do believe it's better to come from a broken home than to live in a broken home. How do you feel about that?
Yes. I really feel there's no reason to, I know it happens to be when you're in an abusive relationship, it's hard to get out. But I find if there's a chance to leave, even if you see, you know, I'm staying there for the children, people a lot of times don't think, oh, they don't realize it, they don't really hear us yelling. They don't. Children, no matter if there's no yelling, they feel the conflict. They feel the turmoil. They feel something wrong. And children always blame themselves. No matter how much you love them, no matter how much you overcompensate and makes excuses and do that, it does affect them. I've had 3-year-olds remember things that happened, what their parents used to do to each other. And I think that's where it starts becoming so damaging. Is yes, you know, if you choose to be in a physically abusive relationship, if you choose to do this, I know it's very hard to leave. But to think that the children are not realizing what's going on, they might not totally understand it in the beginning, but as they get older, they will have a better idea. And I find that if the abuse is active, if you can leave safely, it's healthy to leave. You don't. Unfortunately, I really haven't seen it ever get better. I mean, if the abuser decides to go in therapy full on and anger management and really decides to change his life around, maybe it could be better. But I really, unfortunately, have not seen many cases like that.
And I agree with you. I think that many of the men that we're married to, because of the situation where they're gay men who are trying to keep a secret, that, you know, it's like what comes first, the chicken or the egg. I think they develop narcissistic behavior, controlling behavior, because they have to control their secret so people don't find out. They're very resentful because they're in a marriage where they don't belong, and instead of taking responsibility for it, it's easier to blame their wife and find fault with her. And I think that many of these men develop these, you know, lack of qualities or traits as they get older, because the more you live a lie, I really do believe, you know, the more debilitating it is. I don't know if you've ever dealt with that, someone who has to constantly lie, but I think it is very debilitating.
Yes. Well, I mean, I tell you, if the person has a diagnosed personality disorder, if they're a narcissistic personality, if they're a borderline personality, they are not going to change. This is who they are all the time. This is their way of being. They can maybe learn to have different coping skills or to modify their behaviors. But a lot of people don't understand. It's not about fixing, or if I do this better, if I do that, maybe they'll just understand. There's something missing. They're lacking empathy. They're lacking remorse. They're lacking different things. That means it's not there. It can't be taught. They can maybe have a better idea and realize, okay, this maybe will help me better to move forward in life if I behave or answer in this way. But that takes a lot of work by a professional. I went to a huge conference on personality disorders, and the head doctor said, it's, you know, someone with a personality disorder, imagine it's like one of those old pianos that plays just one song. And say the song is the Jaws theme. It's great. This person goes into a theater and the movie Jaws is on. It's perfect. He fits in fine. But this person goes to a funeral, he's playing the Jaws theme. This person goes to church, he's having the Jaws theme. Everybody else sees that this is totally inappropriate. He doesn't see it because this is who he is. This is how he acts and behaves every situation in his life. So he doesn't have that ego, that being able to say, okay, that super ego, is this working? People are acting different. People, you know, social cues that are going on, unless it's more of a manipulative background, and it helps him. This is who he is all the time.
And that's true.
Yes.
And I think so many times people just are never going to change. And no matter what you do to try to change them, that you can spend a lifetime. But the only one who actually changes, I think, is you.
Yeah.
Because you become somebody who you didn't start out being in many cases. I think that, you know, when you live with someone who is so emotionally abusive to you, you know, when you keep hearing these messages day in and day out that you're the cause of the problems, you know, you're the cause of the problems in the marriage, you're the one who's not good enough, you're the one who doesn't clean the house enough, you're the one who's not sexy enough, you're the one who's too oversexed, you know, it goes from one extreme to the other for all the reasons why if the marriage isn't happy, it's you're making it unhappy, that you just, you know, do what I say, I always call it the, you know, shut me down kind of mentality. Yes, if you keep knock me down and shut me up, you know, then I just won't say anything and I'll just go along with it. I felt like one of those Stepford wives where I just went along with anything he said after a while because I hate conflict. And that's something that always bothered me in my marriage. I was living with somebody who was very volatile, and he certainly wasn't physically, you know, abusive, but it certainly was very strong emotional and verbal abusiveness that he had. And if I did something he didn't like, he would lash out and I would be the victim of the lashing, so I would just give in. And I think by doing that, I really lost who I was. And I was a really strong woman coming into this marriage. I was at the top of the line, top of my life, in tip-top shape, you know, the best shape I'd ever been in my life, physically, emotionally, mentally. And I was a strong woman, but I was beaten down. It didn't take long, a couple of years, and I didn't even know who I was anymore. And worse than that, people didn't know who I was anymore. They used to say to me, what happened to you? You know, why are you like this? You know, you look like you're just out of it. And I wasn't on any medication. You know, I felt so lost in myself. So that's why, you know, these marriages can beat women down. I think if you keep hearing negative messages about yourself, you really start to believe them. Or if you're living with somebody who's either volatile verbally or physically, you're afraid to stand up for yourself. Do you find that with women too?
Yes, yes. And I think, of course, you start to believe them. I mean, this is the person you married. This is at one point the person that you admired or that you were in love with. And I think no matter how many times at first you don't believe it, when someone keeps saying it, it's brainwashing. After a while, anyone gets verbally beaten down for so many years, so and on such an ongoing basis, it's no matter how strong you are, you can't take it. Even if you don't allow people to, you know, hurt your feelings, it's a human thing. You start to believe it. You start losing your sense of self, and then you'll just do anything so you don't have to hear it. You don't have to have the humiliation, because a lot of times these manipulators will do it in front of other people, will embarrass you, will humiliate you. So people learn the other behaviors. It's always damage control. You're always trying to figure out the best way to not have a huge explosion. So you're never able to be yourself. You're never able to kind of be in that relaxed state. You're almost in that fight or flight mode, that heightened mode all the time, that becomes your norm. You think that's how you're supposed to live, so you can't ever take that chance of being yourself and letting your guard down, because it would be a disaster.
I know. I mean, my heart goes out for so many women, not even just part of my network, part of other networks, whenever there's abuse involved, and when I see that they feel so stuck that they can't walk away, and then you have some men who just won't let you walk away. I mean, they refuse to let go. They refuse to let go of their control, and they'll do everything to circumvent whatever you're doing to make your life miserable. So our ex-husbands range from narcissistic to borderline personalities to sociopathic, and when you have to deal with anyone like that, it's never going to be a pleasant outcome, right?
No. No. And you're dealing with expert manipulators. This is a well-thought-out plan. This is who they are. This is what they live for. This is their specialty. And I think, especially if you're never exposed to it or you don't even have an idea of what that evil is, You don't believe it at first. You think you're the one who's crazy. You're saying, what is going on? What happened? I think that's the whole shock value. You're in denial. You're in shock. You're trying to rationalize, trying to bargain, trying to figure out what's going on. And by the time you really start realizing, this is not me, this is them, you're so far into it and into the abuse and all of that, that it's hard to fight back. It's hard to get out of it. Because I think it happens quickly, but it also happens slowly. I think, you know, the mental abuse, the verbal beatdowns, the thinking of, you know, that way of getting yourself to start breaking down your self-confidence is so, so manipulative and so well thought out and planned that I think so many people, to think that someone could actually be capable of that is frightening. But when you're in the field, as you are and myself, I see it. I know that this is this is a borderline personality. This is a narcissistic personality. And I think people, if it's a man or a woman, it's so hard to kind of accept that and say, this is who this person is. It's not an overnight fix if this person, you know, takes medication or if this person acknowledges that they're wrong, it's all going to get better. This person really was out to do with what this was their intention.
I just had a woman write to me. She's in Virginia Beach, Virginia, And she said, Alexa, do you find that husbands of abused women take revenge when you leave and they are abusive physically?
Yes. I find that a lot of times, which is what, you know, when I have a couple or anyone that's in an abusive relationship, it's not my job to ever tell anyone to leave, but when there's severe safety concerns, I do mention, you know, there's safety plans and we speak about what's going on. A lot of times when the woman is either pregnant or when they decide to leave, the man becomes the most violent and goes after them and possibly can take their life. It is, you know, especially that rejection, that idea for that abuser that this person is leaving and rejecting them is so horrific for them that there is a high volume of you know, that this becomes very violent. That's why so many times when I work with abused women who are in active domestic violence situations, it's a long plan. It's a long safety plan. And I know people are like, what do you mean you have her still sitting there getting beaten and doing this? It's not that easy to leave. It's not getting up, getting your bag, and walking out the door. These people will not let you go. You really have to have a plan. You have to have a network. You have to have safety. So I think that's what's so important is being sure you have a plan, being sure you have things in line. You know, is it through the months, through the years, getting copies of your birth certificate, leaving at other people's houses? Is it opening a bank account, putting those bank statements, getting it sent to a P.O. box? Is it, you know, speaking to people, a domestic violence shelter, having, you know, special places that you can go to in case there's an emergency and you need to hide? I mean, all these things have to be thought out because it's a tough, very tough situation.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever run into the cases where the husbands just take the kids and abscond with them?
I've had some where they've wanted to, but mm-hmm. since the woman was in the shelter, they couldn't technically get too far. But, oh, yes, I've mm-hmm. had with clients the abuser actually show up at the shelter and actually, I mean, just very shows how manipulative they are. They worked on the roommate or another woman that was in the shelter that was also an abused woman, and they started, you know, forging this relationship with her, guilting her into, you know, I love my wife. I, you know, please let me come see her. Please, uh-huh. you know, let her. And they, you know, manipulated this person that this person actually allowed them into the building. And he came in and almost killed her.
That is so scary. But that's just to let women know also that these guys are excellent at manipulating, like you said. And they've been manipulating you for years, you know, to get them to do what you want. And, you know, they're not particularly nice to you. But as I always tell women, when you meet a husband who's an abuser, and I think you would agree with this, it's not like on the first date he slaps you across the face. I mean, these men get you into their hold by being charming and loving. You know, at least it seems like they're loving. They'll bring you presents. They'll tell you whatever you want to hear. They'll make you feel like you're so special that you're the only woman in the world who they could ever love. And you're so taken by this because often you're just so needy for someone to truly love you that you buy into it. And the first time that he hits you or abuses you usually isn't within the first week or two. You know, it takes a little time. And after the first time, there's usually so many regrets, and he brings you flowers, and he tells you how much he loves you and that it will never happen again until the next time when it does happen. But it's not mm-hmm. like constantly in the beginning. It's not like you open the door and the guy says, nice to meet you, slap. So, you know, women say, well, he seems like a nice guy, but you can't go by that, right?
No. And I always tell my clients, especially the first couple of weeks, if it's too much too soon, if they're talking about within the first week or two, you're the one, I'm going to marry you, you're the best thing in the world, I can't live without you, let's move in together, they want to see you every day, they want to call you 10 times a day, that is usually a sign, as my colleagues say, there's a personality disorder. Anything too much too soon, because technically, yes, you know, you can really be attracted to someone and that's great and you get excited, but as we get older and we're adults, we know within a week or two, it's chemistry, yes, it's great to have chemistry, but you really have to see who that person is. And I think a lot of times these manipulators come on that strong. And especially if someone has low self-esteem, they don't feel good about themselves. How could you ever talk yourself out of, this guy is great. He told me I'm beautiful. He wants to see me all the time. He buys me flowers. He's always at my house. He's helping me do things. You can't pinpoint something's wrong. And why do you want to burst your own bubble? But I think it's taking a step back saying, it's too much too soon. Let me take a step back and see how does he behave? How does she behave when you say, you know what, today's a little too much. I'm just tired. I'm going to go home. Or, you know what, I think this is a little too much for me. Seeing how they react to rejection. See how they react to boundaries and limits. That's usually a true sign to see somebody's integrity and characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I always say also, get to know their family, get to know their friends. Because those men who are so isolated that they have no family and they have no friends, that has to be a red flag. And a lot of our women are in that situation. They have to meet their families. Well, they live across the country. Well, what about your friends? Well, I moved away from them, too. What about your new friends? I haven't had a chance to make any. I think these are red flags. I'm sorry. You know, I don't know if you feel that way. But I think when somebody's so isolated that you can't check out their life, that this is a red flag for me. What, do you feel that way, too?
Well, I think it's a sign of a pattern. I mean, could mm-hmm. it maybe once be a coincidence? Okay, maybe once it was a coincidence. Who knows? But I think you start seeing patterns. And if it's always, this person was bad, or my family were horrible to me, my coworkers, I left, my friends turned against me. When you start hearing that story on and on again, you start to say, okay, now what was your role in it? What happened? And how easy is it for that person to cut off these important relationships? Someone who can cut off a relationship that quickly, of a mother, of a father, of a brother or a sister, you start to think, okay, what's going on? Unless, you know, of course, it was a very unhealthy relationship. But if they've cut off major relationships in their life, major work, they can't keep a job, they keep leaving jobs, the bosses are always horrible, you start to see a pattern. And you start to say, okay, something, there's a common denominator here. What's going on? And if the person can't explore it, then I think then you start seeing a red flag.
That's one of them for sure. And also, I think women just don't check out men good enough anymore. You know, we're just willing to accept things with blind faith because the guy seems like a great guy. And recently, one of my members who lives in the South, you know, she came to me because she had met someone and she kind of fell for him. There was an attraction there, and it was the first time since the end of her marriage a couple years ago. And she was just happy that somebody liked her and they got along well and they talked well. And, you know, I said to her, don't be, you know, so quick to think that everything's fine, because I feel that usually by the time that a man is in his late 50s or 60s, he's led a life and there's a lot of baggage that develops with it. I mean, just like with women too, you know, we all develop baggage, and it's just a matter of degree of how much baggage can you live with. And I said, you know, it's fun to practice and have a good time, but you can't really look to make any kind of commitment until you get to know him better. And sure enough, she wrote to me a few days later. You know, we talked in between, and, you know, I gave her chores and advice of what to do. And he was a player. You know, he certainly wasn't playing the game that she was looking for. But there are a lot of these guy players out there, because there are a lot of vulnerable women. And they know that they can have a good time with them and they can just dump them because they're vulnerable women. And then I always feel you feel worse. You know, I went through that when I started dating again, you know, 25 years ago. That, you know, I was finally ready 11 years after my marriage to meet somebody new. And I got myself in pretty good shape and, you know, I was looking pretty good and feeling good about myself. And I allowed myself to just be run over by a bunch of guys, you know, one at a time, of course, who I believed whatever they said, because it's been so long since I really dated anybody. And then I would, like, check out different things when they weren't looking, like who they really were, and it wasn't even the right person, you know. So I think that would be enough to make me say goodbye. But I think that it's a whole new world for women who have been married for 20, 30, 40 years, and they haven't been out there. So if you don't build yourself up first, I think that's the message, that you have to get to know who you are, what you're looking for, and learn not to fall in love on the first or second or fifth date. even though it's hard because, you know, I'm a person who falls in love with love. I know that other women have been lacking it for so long. But if you do that, you're doomed. I mean, you'll just keep repeating these same mistakes and finding these same guys who are not worthy of you.
Yes.
Do you find it hard to meet great guys, Alexa? You have it all.
Still
not easy, right?
No, I don't think it. I think it's hard. I think, you know, it's really finding what, you know, you're looking for and building your sense of self. But then also, you know, yes, you don't want to ruin the excitement of meeting someone, but I think you really have to have open eyes and being able to really see, you know, yes, it's great to have chemistry with someone and you're attracted to them and they seem like a great guy, but it's still taking that step back and letting time tell. And I think usually when I say within the first couple of hours, people will tell you who they are. Listen to it. Don't make excuses. Don't say, oh, they just said it because they were nervous or maybe this wasn't it. They usually tell you within the first couple of hours who they are and what they are. And I think it's listening. And if you don't agree with it or it's a deal breaker for you, no matter how much you like them, I think it's walking away.
I know. And that's hard sometimes because we are by nature caretakers and fixer-uppers. And we have to learn the lessons from our past that we're unable to fix up people who are broken. I mean, that shouldn't be our role and that shouldn't be our job. We have to look for people who are mentally healthy. And I really feel that if we have to be the ones to fix up people, then we're really the ones who need the fixing up. Because it's one thing when you're with somebody and you love someone and something happens and you have to take care of them. There are no guarantees in life. Somebody gets sick. Somebody has an accident. I mean, there's a number of circumstances where you are going to have to take care of people that you weren't counting on. But if you go into a relationship and you see a man is broken and you say, this is a good project for me, like this old house, this old man, you know, I can sit and I can fix him up and make him like new, then I think that you're the one with the problem because you can't walk in knowing there's these problems and that you think you can change them. What do you say? That's pretty accurate.
Yes, and I think what happens, you give this, how do you know this person even wants to fix themselves? That's
exactly.
What I think it's always, I think a lot of times we find ourselves giving people potential that they don't really have. We idealize them. We say, if they only lived their life like this or if they only did this. And a lot of times the person doesn't want to. They're very happy with who they are, what they are, even if it's manipulative, even if you don't think they're happy or successful. It's working for them, distorted or not. But I think it's, you know, it's by saying, okay, I can help them see the light. That's not what a relationship is about. Yes, we learn from each other and we grow, but we have to be on the same page, and we have to have the same type of morals and the same type of integrity and beliefs, you know, of what is right and wrong to think that, okay, this can actually be someone long-term. We don't change that. And if someone thinks that or doesn't see anything wrong with being verbally abusive or physically abusive, that's not, you know, just someone likes white clam sauce, somebody likes spaghetti sauce. It's not like that. This is very serious. And I think it's really saying, you know what, don't sugarcoat it and don't kind of be in denial and give somebody potential that they don't really have.
And I think keeping along those lines, I have a very, very close friend who's like a sister to me. And she was chasing after this impossible dream for 8 years of a man who was really broken. And she kept hoping against hope that he could change, and he wouldn't. And he would build her up and let her down. This went on and off, you know, over time for like 8 years. And finally she said, you know what? I accept the fact, you know, he's never going to change. Isn't that a shame for him? He must not be happy. How could he live like that? I said, guess what? He's happy living like that. He doesn't want to change. And just because you think people shouldn't be happy doesn't mean they're not happy. They can be very happy being dysfunctional, right?
Yes, it works for them. And I think that's the scary. If it serves whatever purpose they need, and as long as they don't see a problem with it, you're not going to show them that there's a problem with it. They have to figure it out on their own. This is their journey. This is what they have to figure out. You can't show them. You can't tell them. They're going to have to want to. That's the difference.
But within their thought patterns, if they think they're right, then there's no sense trying to change it. I mean, where do you come up with, like I used to say to her, he's happy being like this. Where do you feel like he's not happy? If he said to you, I want to change and I know that I'm not happy like this, but he's not saying that. He's saying you're stubborn. You know, it's not like he's taking any responsibility for his bad behavior. He'll just put it
and
elsewhere.
That's a red flag.
Mm-hmm. It definitely is. I mean, if there's not that, you know, cooperation when people have a relationship of give and take, and it can't be all one way or another. But once again, you know, there's always takers and givers, so I understand the need for the givers to get a taker, and a taker is looking for the giver. But it can't be 90-10. I mean, it really needs to be close to 50-50. Otherwise, you're going to lose yourself in that relationship. Before we go, I just want to get your opinion, because I know there's a lot of different opinions, including mine. When you're healing, you know, from a situation, is forgiveness really necessary?
It depends on what your definition of forgiveness is. I think each person's definition of forgiveness is so personal. And if that person needs to let go of that person, or that person needs to have that person say they're sorry, or maybe if it helps you to forgive that person, if it serves you, then yes. But if you're giving forgiveness just to, because you think it's that it'll help this person care about you or to move forward, I think it's really finding out what is it. I work with a lot of clients that have had, you know, sexual abuse within the family. And they feel like, well, I need to have still a relationship with them. I need to do this. I said, each person is so different. You just through therapy, you might find your closure. Or you might just write a letter and never send it. Or you might really need to have a sit-down conversation with them. I said, but that all takes time. It's not one night you're going to say, okay, boom, this is how I'm going to get my forgiveness. This is how I'm going to get my closure. You have to honor yourself and say, what does forgiveness mean for me? How does that serve me? What is my closure? And move from there.
Because I tell women a lot of times, I know there's different points of view on this, and if it works for you, great, but if it doesn't work for you, you shouldn't have to feel bad. I say that I believe in acceptance more than forgiveness.
Yes.
For me, forgiveness isn't always the option, but I can accept a situation so that I can move on with it. I can forgive myself for staying in it. I think that's where forgiveness has to begin, that you forgive yourself for staying somewhere too long or making the wrong choice. Because we often beat ourselves up over that. Why did I stay so long? Why didn't I see it sooner? The red flags are staring me in the face. I mean, I think you need to forgive yourself, because a lot of times you do at the time what you do because you need to do it. And I never judge people when they make decisions like that. You can never say why somebody makes a mistake, because at that particular moment, that's what you needed to do. But that doesn't mean you can't fix a mistake. And I just feel that you can move on, and you don't have to necessarily forgive someone. You can accept the situation and forgive yourself. Do you think that could work?
Yes. Yes. I really agree. I think acceptance is the major key, is being able to accept and say, okay. And maybe accept that you might not ever really be able to forgive them. You're willing to let go of it in your heart and maybe try and cut down on the hatred and on the anger or on the pain.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes time. I think you'll know within years. I think it's not something that just comes overnight. Again, honor yourself and give yourself the time, and do not put a time limit on when your forgiveness or acceptance should be.
Yeah, I just find it really hard to forgive when somebody really hurts me, because that, to me, now this is me personally, other people don't agree, it just makes me feel like I'm still a victim. You know, I feel that not only did they damage me, but now I have to say, it's okay. You know, I forgive you. And I, you know, that's, some people believe that and they feel better doing that, and I can appreciate that. I just don't feel better. I feel better by saying, I can accept what you did to me, and now that's it. I'm moving on.
Yes, and that's forgiveness.
Lingering with you.
That is, that's a healthy forgiveness. Why keep putting yourself subject to, once in a while, yes, something happens, people fight, they don't do the right thing. But if it's an ongoing thing, you have to protect yourself and not keeping that person in your life. Walking away and saying, putting the boundaries down that you can't be in my life anymore, that's forgiveness and acceptance. That's the healthiest way of doing it.
Well, we're on the same page with that, Alexa. So with that being said, how can people, now, are you taking private patients?
Yes, I'm taking private patients in my New York office. You can find me on Psychology Today, or you can give me a call. My office is 914-396-2435.
Or if you can get in touch with me, and I'll be happy to give you Alexa's information. Also, they can see you on Facebook at Insight Into Healing, correct?
Yes. And also the Alexa
show.
The
radio show. Well, and also yeah. Alexa has her television show, The Alexa Show. And Alexa just had one of our own members on there recently, Janine Finelli, right?
Yes, she was amazing. Yes, and the TV show, she's coming out in season two of The Alexa Show. She was on. She's amazing.
I know. I love Janine. She's been at our, you know, several of our healing weekends, and she has a beautiful presentation. And we have some wonderful members of our network who hopefully will be on your shows this upcoming season. And Marianne Glinton, she's part of our, also of our healing here. She's been on your show, right?
Yes. She was amazing with her anxiety, the anxiety application that she has.
Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that we're all working to try to make life better for so many people. And once again, when are your show is on Wednesday nights on the radio, correct?
Yes, Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. on blogtalkradio.com/AlexaS29, starting in September. And also, the Alexa show is on Sundays at 8 p.m. on AlexaTVShow.com, starting September 13th.
Right, and, you know, it's really great because on the television show, there's a wonderful chat room. You can chat while the guests are on there with Alexa. And you meet so many really wonderful people who are wonderful people like us. And so it's really important to try to take the opportunity to find Alexa's show because before she becomes too big on Broadway, and you won't be doing those shows. What's going to happen then,
I
Alexa?
I will still do it. I'm telling you, I'm a multitasker. I've been putting everything together. I love doing the radio show, and I love doing the television show. It is just, I've met the most amazing people on this show.
Yeah, well,
it's just amazing.
Well, and you are amazing as a hostess, I will say that. And we'll be spreading around the show once your show starts in September again. I'll send out notices to all of our members and post it on our private room and Facebook. So thank you so much for joining us. And I'm going to be counting on you coming back in another 6 months to spread, you know, the wonderful words that you have. I'm sorry to keep annoying you, but I'll keep doing it anyway. And
no,
I
love it. I love
really
being on the show.
From this. And thank you so much. And to all of our listeners, love to all of you. Have a wonderful week. If you'd like to get in touch with Alexa, send me a note at bondk@aol.com. All right, Alexa, I love you. Thank you for being part of this.
Love you, too. Good night.
All right, good night, everybody. Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.